two. We know that like the back of our hand. And that's okay. What else really, we really know pretty well? Acts chapter 10, conversion of the, all of those examples of conversion, by the way, should be really familiar to you. Now, we ended last week with our last conversion chapter, Acts chapter 19. And Acts chapter 20, so there are more known sections of the book of Acts than perhaps other sections that we feel as that we're as knowledgeable about. But that's correctable. We can stand to correct that by doing what? More studying. And when there's a book of the Bible or a section in a book that we're studying, or a book as a whole, if I feel like, you know, I'm just not sure about what the book of Habakkuk's all about, well, spend some time studying that. And I've given you before, not to take much of our time, but I've given you before when we did a lengthy study on an overview of the Bible. Remember the material I gave you? There's some other really good resources that are just a little small, concise, gives a little synopsis of what every book of the Bible is about. You can tuck that, we put that out in the foyer. And if you didn't get one of those, let me know and we'll try to get that for you. But be familiar with as much of the Bible as you possibly can. So we get to the 20th chapter of the book of Acts. And you may read Acts chapter 20 and you may say there's just not a lot going on in Acts chapter 20. But there is a lot of things that you can get a lot of good points from this chapter, because as Paul has been going with Barnabas and perhaps Luke and with John Mark and with Timothy and others to go on these trips to proclaim the gospel, he continuously runs into problems because he has some that want to stir up the brethren against him. And by and large, who was that? Even followed him to various places. Yeah, the Jews, unhappy with what Paul was doing. And that's going to continue, and Paul's going to be called into question. Ultimately, he's going to make his appeal unto Caesar and then make the voyage to where?
Rome.
To Rome. And that's where the book of Acts is going to close, in Acts chapter 28, with Paul being in prison. But in Acts chapter 20, begin with verse 1, after the uproar was ceased, Paul called unto him the disciples and embraced them and departed for to go into Macedonia. I'm always encouraged by the apostles, not just Paul, but the others, who, even though they had stout persecution, didn't quit. It's tempting so many times when we maybe have opposition in various different ways to just kind of back off, and we get maybe discouraged and we say, well, maybe I ought not do whatever the case may be. Maybe I shouldn't be as bold. Maybe I shouldn't be as busy. But Paul and the apostles, and you think of what they, how they were mistreated and persecuted, just continued to preach the gospel. When he had gone over those parts and had given them much exhortation, he came into Greece. Verse 2 is a verse that throws my mind back to Acts chapter 14. When the Bible says, as they made that first journey, what did they do at the end of that journey? They did what? They went back through, revisited the brethren. And specifically, the text says in Acts chapter 14, in verse 22, that they exhorted them to continue in the faith. And so Paul just continued to exhort the brethren. Why is it important to exhort? Go ahead, Walt.
In verse 1, we see where Paul called them together and embraced them. I think we can get from that that when we're leaving, we don't just leave. We let the brethren and the sisters know what we're going to do, and they encourage them to continue. And I think we see where Paul did that here, instead of just taking off and nobody knows what's going on.
Yeah, it's a good thought. And you see, in line with what Will just mentioned, the mutual care and concern that Paul and the brethren had. And we see that in Acts chapter, we'll see that later on in this chapter, before he leaves. And even another point, he began to weep. Why do you weep and break my heart? But they fell on Paul's neck, kissed him, and so forth as he left. Very good point, Bernice.
Verse 3
my study in chapter 4 this past week, you've got Peter and John being arrested. They were commanded not to teach or preach in Jesus' name anymore. Well, they were took into council. They prayed for boldness. So when you're faced with persecution, we need to pray for boldness to continue to stand and carry out the mission that God has given us.
Yeah, good. So, and we'll make some more thoughts about that. Very good. So why the importance of exhortation? Acts chapter 14 and Acts chapter 20.
I mean, you think about it, they just saw this uproar. So, I mean, in other words, to embolden somebody, to encourage them to continue.
To encourage them. And he said to embolden, is that what they,
yes.
Yeah. And to embolden them. And I think about what Bernice said as well. When we fall into various different obstacles and circumstances that might be trying to our faith or whatever the case may be. I mean, we know in James chapter 1, he says, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations. And we can pray about as Bernice talked about, pray for boldness and so forth. The Lord even said in the Sermon on the Mount, when you're persecuted, what did he say?
Rejoice,
for great is your reward in heaven. Be exceedingly, exceedingly glad. And so it's the exhortation to encourage brethren to continue in the faith, come what may, to just continue to do what God would have you to do, to embolden, encourage. And I think of no better passage, and we'll get there close to the end of this chapter, Acts chapter 20 and then verse 32, and now, brethren, I commend you unto God and the word of his grace, which is able to build you. Say it again, Blaine. Which is able to build you up and give you, that is, encourage, build you up, edify. And able to build you up, give you an inheritance among all them that are sanctified. He came into Greece after that, then, and there abode 3 months. And we read various places where Paul spent various lengths of time at different places. Talks about 3 years later on in this chapter, but 3 months. And when the Jews laid wait for him as he was about to sail into Syria, he proposed to return through Macedonia, and there accompanied him into Asia. And think about Paul's traveling companion. If you were making a list of those that traveled with Paul, you could just keep growing that list. I mean, we mentioned some, but briefly, quickly, Name his traveling companions. Begin in Acts chapter 13. He's getting ready to add some more. Who? First of all, read about Barnabas. Right?
About Silas.
Mark.
Timothy.
No, possibly Luke. Yeah. That's who the us is in reference to. I'm going to abbreviate this. Aquila and Priscilla. And then he talks about, and there accompanied him into Asia, Sopater of Berea, and of the Thessalonians, Aristarchus and Secundus and Gaius of Derbe, and Timotheus or Timothy, and of Asia, Tychicus and Trophimus. These gone before tarried for, there's this pronoun, us, at Troas. And we sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread. Well, there you go. There's an example of them keeping an Old Testament feast of the Jews. I assure you people's gone think like that. There's an example of when the disciples observed an Old Testament feast. Therefore, the law of Moses is still binding. What's the problem with that? Just face value, what's the problem with that? It's not what the text says. The text didn't say they kept it. Just simply makes a statement that after the days of unleavened bread. That's all he says. Did he say that the Christians met and observed the Old Testament feast of the Jews? No, the text didn't say. They just simply said that after the days of unleavened bread, they left Philippi and came unto them to Troas in 5 days, where we abode 7 days. And someone may bring up and ask a question, why did they tarry at Troas for these number of days? The most often answer that I've heard to that is what? What have you heard? That Paul tarried at Troas for the first day of the week. Yeah, to do what they're getting, what the text gets ready to talk about in verse 7. Now, whether that's the case, I don't know. Because again, it doesn't say that. But we know what they did do while they were there, which is an important takeaway. While they were at Troas, they abode there 7 days. Now here's verse 7. You could take and make a whole Bible class out of it. Upon the first day of the week, when the disciples came together to break bread, Paul preached unto them, ready to depart on the morrow, and continued his speech until midnight. Why do we use Acts chapter 20 and in verse 7 to as a verse to authorize what we're going to do this morning with the Lord's Supper? Good. Now, that's an example of what? So the Lord's Supper. I'm going to stop there for just a moment. So if you don't already know this, you can follow me logically. Is Acts chapter 20, verse 7 the only place in the New Testament that authorizes the partaking of the Lord's Supper? No. Blaine said no. Everybody agree with Blaine? There's other passages. And for example, 1 Corinthians chapter 11. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 mentions it. And 1 Corinthians chapter 11 does too. So we know that the Lord's Supper, the partaking of it, is authorized. No doubt about that. But Acts chapter 20, verse 7 is unique. Because it is the only verse that does what? Other verses tell us what to do. Who said that? Jan? Acts 20, verse 7 is unique because it tells us when they did it. So you have to have Acts chapter 20, verse 7. You don't have to have it to show that the Lord's Supper is authorized, but you need it to show that this is when it is authorized. 1 Corinthians chapter 11 is an excellent passage to show, one, that it's authorized. Two, that they were observing it in the first century. That's who Paul wrote to. They had problems with it, but Paul was addressing that in that chapter. It tells you the purpose of it, and this do in remembrance of me, for as often as you eat this bread, drink this cup, you do show the Lord's death. That's the purpose of it. And then it shows us the duration of it. Till, which is a time stamp, till, say it again, Brent, till he comes, till he come again. That's how often we do it. That's why we do it. That's how long we do it. But Acts chapter 20, verse 7 is our verse that shows the frequency of it. But then there's other questions that people want to ask about the frequency. And usually they want to say, they want a question.
How often you do it?
How often you do it? Well, it didn't say that they did it every first day of the week. And that's usually what they'll say. We've talked before, and I've mentioned to you, the people that I've studied with, they believe the Lord's Supper. They believe that you should partake of the Lord's Supper. They have no problem with saying what it's for, and they have no problem with saying how long you are to do it, but they get hung up on the frequency of it, as though you can do it monthly or quarterly or annually or at maybe a couple times a year, maybe at Christmas time and at Easter time. Bernice?
Well, Donnie, when I'm studying, I like to use what I refer to as the 5 W's. Who, what, when, where, why, and sometimes how. Okay, and here we see the who, when, and why, just like you pointed out. They did it when they come together. They didn't do it at home by themselves. They came together to do it. That's a point I believe that a lot overlook. I can't partake the Lord's Supper at home by myself.
That's right. That's right. And Acts chapter 20 is a good passage for that. And 1 Corinthians chapter 11, you just can't get around. Because in the context of to that point, to can I take it at home? In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, he's addressing who in the book? He's addressing the church. And he's talking about the church at Corinth's misuse of the Lord's Supper. That's the, see that you do it irreverently or not discerning the Lord's, that means in an irreverent manner. He's not saying whether or not I'm individually worthy to do that. I mean, we'd probably all say we're not and won't even take it. But he's talking about the manner in which it is observed. So the context of it, he's addressing the church. The phrase you can't get around in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 is when he says, when you come together. And he uses the phrase, in the church. Well, me sitting at home, ladies and gentlemen, is not the church gathered together. You agree with that point?
Absolutely.
It's not. I'm not the church.
Maybe just read the Bible.
Yeah, I'm not the church. I'm a member of the church. You see that? So if I'm at home, I'm not the church at home. So we need to see that. So 1 Corinthians 11, Acts chapter 20, you've got to have those two passages. But briefly to that point about the frequency of it. Someone says, but it did not say every. And so how do you answer that? It didn't say every first day of the week. And that's right, the text does not say every first day of the week. So how do we arrive then at the conclusion that it is to be done every first day of the week?
Because every week has a first day.
Okay. Every week has a first day. Now, and the point is, in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, he said you do it till the Lord comes, so we know that it is to continually be done. Well, again, when is it to be done? Here's our example that on the first day of the week. How else might you answer that? Maybe someone says, well, you know, if there was just a good example of God giving a command, and yet they understood it to be every week, though the text didn't say every, they understood it to be every. Man, if I had an example like that, I'd be on fire.
I'm talking about the Sabbath.
Good. Ray, explain that to us about how we can use the Sabbath day to show people that even though it doesn't say every, he didn't have to.
Well, we know that whenever, if Jesus did a good work on the Sabbath, they weren't at liberty to say, well, I'm only going to observe two Sabbaths out of the month instead of all four. I mean, so they understood that every seventh day was to be a day of rest.
So every week had a Sabbath. So in very good explanation of that, just very simple for people to see that. Don't make it complicated.
And so actually every week has a seventh day.
It has a seventh day. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Now, he didn't say remember every Sabbath. But how often did the Jews remember the Sabbath to keep it holy? And how did they know to do that? Because he said to keep it. And so as often as it rolled around. All right, so Acts chapter, any questions or thoughts about that?
To me, when people use stuff like that to get around something, they're not honestly looking for truth. My check goes in the bank, let's say the third Wednesday of the month. Does it say you'll go in there every third Wednesday of every month? No, but I've got enough sense to know that's what it means.
There's a little
bit. They have no problem understanding that.
There's a little illustration that we've used in the preacher training. It's a little picture. I know some of these guys here had it, and some of the ladies too. That's a placard that was in a restaurant that says, "Lions meet here Tuesdays, or Tuesday at 6. And guess how often they met there? Every Tuesday. If you want to, I've got that upstairs. You want to copy that? It's a good little illustration to show people how we know the frequency was upon the first day of the week. One other little point about verse 7 is the phrase breaking of bread. Not every time when the Bible talks about breaking bread is it talking about the Lord's Supper. I feel like I just made that point in a sermon here. It could have been one of the meetings, but not every time. How do I know whether or not he's talking about the Lord's Supper will always be determined by the context of it. He's getting ready to use breaking of bread, but not talking about the Lord's Supper later on, just a few verses down. But sometimes it is in reference to the Lord's Supper, like Acts chapter 20 and in verse 7. That didn't say that they came together on the first day of the week to eat a meal. That's not what he's talking about. They can do that any day of the week. But he's specifically talking about the Lord's Supper. In Acts chapter 2 and in verse 42, they continue steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and in fellowship and in breaking of bread and in prayer. Someone says, well, that could have just been eating. Well, in the context of it, it's spiritual work that he's talking about. Why would that one not be? The fellowship is spiritual, continues steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine is spiritual. Why would that one then not be spiritual? But then you also have the statement in Matthew chapter 26. When the Lord instituted, he took the bread and did what? After he had, he break it and then gave thanks. And that stated in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. The bread which we break, is it not the communion of the body of Christ? And that's a passage, by the way, in reference to the Lord's Supper that you can use to show that it is referred to as communion. Communion means what? Yeah, it has this idea of fellowship or a sharing together, and it is a communion. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, Blaine.
Next, 2:46, it talks about there, so they continue daily with one accord in the temple and breaking bread from house to house. They ate their food with gladness and simplicity of heart. So that talks about a meal right there.
It sometimes does. We're getting ready to see an example of that in this same chapter. So the bread which we break is not the communion. And so it can be in reference to the Lord's Supper. It can be in reference to a meal, as Blaine just mentioned from Acts chapter 2. And we'll see that in just a moment. But Paul preached unto them ready to depart. Why did he preach? Well, first of all, the importance of the proclamation of the gospel.
And exhortation.
Exhortation. Is preaching of the Word of God to be included in the worship? How do you know? Say it again.
He did it right here.
He did it right here. Here's an example of the church coming together, observe the Lord's Supper, and preaching was done. He was ready to depart on the morrow and continued his speech until midnight. And there were many lights in the upper chamber where they were gathered together. We could just park on any one of these verses and just go on it. Acts chapter 20 and then verse 7, we've seen what it authorizes. Guess what verse 8 authorizes? Someone says the church is not authorized to have a meeting place. There's no authority in the scriptures for this, for the church out of the treasury to build and maintain this facility for worship. They evidently did not read Acts chapter 20, verse 7 and 8. Because where were they at? Yeah, specifically, where were they? They were in upper chamber. Or a preacher, that building down on Mill Street's not an upper chamber. Not the point. The point is that you're authorized to have a meeting place. God's never commanded us to do something and forbidden on getting the job done. Now, the means he's conditioned, but we've got to get the job done. What else does it authorize?
Overhead lights.
Many lights on. Someone said, well, you're not authorized to have electricity in that building down there. Where's it? Now, the reason people say things like that is because they want to bring in something they're doing, and they're trying to say, okay, if you authorize the lights, and if you authorize the seat you're sitting on, and if you authorize the building, and you authorize the songbook or the tray for the fruit of the vine and the bread, then our fellowship hall is authorized. Our gymnasium is authorized. Our hospital we run is authorized. So that won't work. Our orphan home is authorized. Not so. Not so. These are aids that help get the job done. The others are additions to the work that God as said to do, and we could just talk and talk about that. But they were gathered together, and they're sat in a window. We got 5 minutes. They're sat in a window, a certain young man named Eutychus, being fallen into a deep sleep. And as Paul was long preaching, "Preacher, you talk too long." Now, the last time that somebody told me that in a roundabout way, he was just kidding with me, but I said, "Well, Paul was long preaching." He said, "Guess what? You're not Paul." I understand. I understand I don't preach like Paul, but the point is that we have so conditioned ourselves to quit. I want my food quick, go for the drive-thru. Everything's got to be quick. YouTube has been, move over long videos to YouTube Shorts because I don't have but a second. The time when people listen many times to a 30-minute radio, that's very few will do that anymore. Too long for them. Pick up a lengthy track, people don't want it. They want a placard that they can just read and in just a split second, done with it. Now, I'm not saying those things are wrong in and of themselves, but we have so conditioned allowed ourselves to be conditioned, we expect it from preaching. We expect our worship. If we're not done at the top of the hour, it's too long. Communion took too long. The prayers are too long. The song service is too long. We want sermonettes instead of sermons. And that's just how a lot of people are beginning, if not already, to think. And we've got to be careful about that. And I'm not saying preaching ought to be long. And I tell guys in the preacher training, what I try to tell them, don't worry about the time. To preach as long as it takes to get your sermon done. Don't preach for the sake of being long, and don't preach for the sake of being short. Just preach a sermon and let it fall. But people expect many times for it to be quick. Well, this man was in the window. Paul was preaching. This man fell asleep. And I've been preaching before and people fall asleep, but they went in the window and didn't get hurt. And people do go to sleep for different reasons. I understand that. Medication, had a long night, you worked at night. I understand all that. But this man fell asleep, fell out the window, out the loft, and was taken up dead. Paul went down and fell on him, and embracing him said, "Trouble not yourselves, for his life is in him." When he therefore was come up again and had what? Broken bread. Is that in reference to the Lord's Supper? How do you know it's not in reference to the Lord's Supper? Yeah, and eaten. But how we know specifically that it was not in reference to the Lord's Supper? Just face value. Don't make it hard.
Doesn't look like it. It looked like it's just him.
Yeah, and they'd already partook of the Lord's Supper. They had already done that. And then Paul was preaching. And then here's a little point to that as well. The text says that there was a certain young man. Was Eutychus a Christian? Yes or no? Or I'll give you a third option. I don't know. Which one? I don't know either. It just said a young man. How young? I don't know. Had he obeyed the gospel and partook of the Lord's Supper in Acts 20 verse 7? I don't know. I have no idea. I think many times we assume Eutychus was a Christian. Now, unless there's a verse that I've overlooked, and that happens, then I'll be happy to be staying corrected on that. And then I'll learn too. But Paul went down, fell on embracing him, said, "Trouble not yourselves, for his life is in him." He ate, talked a long while, even till break of day, so he departed. And they brought the young man alive, and were not a little. In the King James Version, that means what? In other words, they were a lot, not a little, but a lot comforted. Don't forget about the things you can learn from this passage. And sometimes we read it as though, well, we just the only thing we can learn from this section is the fact that we're authorized to take the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week. Not so. You could just go and go. Any comments or questions about that? Anything that I missed? Because I want you, if I miss something, you tell me. It's not going to make me mad, hurt my feelings. I'll learn too and not make the same mistake again. Appreciate your good attention.